It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, the next time you dig into a green papaya salad or a big plate of pad thai, think about the origin of that food. I mean, we say Thai food, but in Thailand, diners talk the distinct dishes of the regions, lampang, buriram. Just like in Italy and China and here, the food changes, and the influences that weigh in are very interesting.
Most interesting dishes were developed in royal households around the country because they're the people that had the means, so their cooks could afford to buy all the special ingredients. Also, they were able to pay cooks who were really, you know, dedicated to their art.
Well, today we're looking at the not well-known regional foods of Thailand with our friend Andy Ricker of the Pak Pak Eateries. Stay with us. There's lots more coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It's hard to resist a person who describes himself as a big white guy who is proud to be copycatting the cooks of Thailand. Years ago, Andy Ricker blew Portland, Oregon out of the water with his street stand, Pak Pak. And since then, he's never looked back. With Pak Pak restaurants in both Portland and New York City, he's determined to bring us the authentic tastes of regional Thailand. And let me tell you, his food is beyond delicious. He does things you rarely find in Thai restaurants. He's captured some of those recipes in his new book, Pak Pak. Andy, good to have you back with us.
It's great to be back. Thanks.
You know, there's something that this book brought to mind. People always say Thai food, but you do a whole thing on regions, and it's not something we're familiar with. So can you kind of give us the gloss on regional Thai food?
Sure. So when you say Thai food, when you're in Thailand and you say Thai food, you're referring to the center of Thailand. That's where the Thai people live, the ethnically Thai people. But Thailand really is broken down into four distinct regions. There's the south, the center, the northeast or Isan, and northern Thailand. And they all have different ethnolinguistic backgrounds, different food traditions, terroir, different ingredients that they have access to that has formed the cuisine.
So can you give us an idea of these areas? What are they like and what's the food about?
Well, starting in the south of Thailand, in peninsular southern Thailand, the folks down there are ethnically Malay mostly, and the language is different. Pak Thai folks speak a sort of a different dialect. And the food down there tend towards the very spicy. Also, it's where most of the coconut groves are, where, you know, the stuff like coconut cream and products that come from coconut originate. So there tends to be some very thick and rich coconut curries down there, a lot of seafood. The staple rice there is jasmine rice. A typical dish down there might be something called gang thai bla, which is a curry, a very, very spicy curry made from fish stomach. And it's super spicy. It's got a little bitter element to it. That'd be a typical southern Thai dish. And when you get to the center of Thailand, that's kind of like the center of Thai culture. That's where the Thai people are. That's where most of the food that we find in restaurants here in America comes from the center part of Thailand. That's the seat of power. Bangkok is in the center at the Chao Phraya River Delta. And so a lot of the country's vegetables and fruits are grown nearby. Center of industry, the Royal Palace, which has a huge influence on the food of Thailand. So the staple rice there is jasmine, and the foods there tend to be the sort of more refined dishes, as well as a lot of Chinese dishes from that area too.
Hmm.
A central Thai dish, something that we'd be familiar with would be like gang pet bed yang, which is the red curry with roasted duck in it. So you kind of have this fusion of Thai ingredients with roasted duck, which is a Chinese thing.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of indicative of a central Thai dish. And then northeastern Thailand or Isan, where the folks there are mostly ethnically Lao and some Khmer, very arid climate. and the food tends to be quite simple, spicy. Sticky rice is the staple, and also they favor something called pala or padek, which is the fermented freshwater fish that's quite funky, and they make a fish sauce out of that. Probably the most iconic dish that comes from there is somtam or papaya salad, or tam som as they call it there too. And then you get into northern Thailand, Chiang Mai and regions around there bordered by Laos and Burma. And the food there, we're in a mountainous, jungly region. And so the food tends to be herbaceous, a little bit of bitter enters into the flavor mm-hmm. profile there. Lots of freshwater fish, domesticated animals. And the staple rice there is sticky rice. Not a lot of coconut up there historically. So the old school sort of traditional food from there tends to be more brothy, steamed food, and boiled food is kind of the norm. Maybe lab, a minced meat salad made with offal and blood and lots of herbs and fried garlic and shallots and spices.
Yes, and it's really popular.
Yes.
See it a lot. Yeah. You have traveled in Thailand now for what, almost 2 decades?
A little bit over that. I think the first time I went was 1987.
How did you connect with people? Because your recipes aren't what you're going to be served in the hotel or whatever.
Well, I was lucky enough on the second time I went there in 1992 to be there to visit a friend of mine that I grew up with who had moved to Chiang Mai, had met a woman at the university he was working at, and they had gotten married, had a couple kids. And his wife, Lakana, the guy's name is Chris. His wife's name is Lakana. She's from a small village near Chiang Mai and a very northern Thai family. So they first introduced me to some dishes there. And we talk about it in the book a little bit, a dish called gang head top or yum head top, a wild mushroom dish. And then her father taught on a subsequent visit, taught me how to make the northern Thai lab. So really, I started learning from the family of Chris and his wife, Lakana. And then a network of friends materialized from that via the university, and I started learning with them. And after a while, I just kind of I showed so much kind of like, I guess, obsession with the food that,
yeah.
that people began to accept that I was really truly interested in the local food, and I was able to start getting access to stuff that you typically don't if you're a tourist.
And that's a big reason why the food in your restaurants doesn't taste like most of the Thai food we've had anywhere else. Andy, thanks for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Andy Ricker is author with J.J. Good of Pak Pak. And he's chef owner of the veritable Pak Pak Empire in New York and Portland, Oregon. Now, you can find his recipe for stir-fried chicken with hot basil on the website splendidtable.org. Talk regionality in the United States without thinking about the Stearns, Jane and Michael. I mean, they've been crisscrossing this country for decades, searching out the best in local eating. They report on it in their myriad books, on their website, roadfood.com, and here. Hey, guys, Jane, Michael, good to have you back.
Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
So, where have you been?
We've been in a really odd part of Florida, because so many people think of Florida as Miami or Key West or Boca Raton. We were in the bottom part of the panhandle that goes where the Gulf of Mexico is, and it is really unexplored territory and fascinating.
And delicious.
This is that long stretch that runs right along the Gulf of Mexico. Is this like Pensacola and that area?
Basically, we started in Pensacola, wound our way along the shore to the east, and then headed up towards Tallahassee. And there was great food all along the way, especially great seafood once you get to around Apalachicola. But the very first place we stopped when we landed in Pensacola was a kind of a, not a specifically seafood place, but a wonderful old diner called Jerry's Drive-In. Since 1939, it's been there. And their claim to fame, as listed on their sign outside, is that they are the home of the bacon cheeseburger.
They invented the bacon cheeseburger?
So they claim. Now, we saw no evidence or proof of this matter. But we did, of course, order a bacon cheeseburger. And what's interesting about the bacon cheeseburger at Jerry's is that it's not spectacular in any way. It's a normal-sized diner hamburger with a normal-sized square of sliced cheese and a couple of strips of regular bacon on an ordinary bun. Nothing grand about it, but it's just kind of the perfect drive-in hamburger.
And I think Jerry's is sort of the perfect drive-in,
yes.
Even though we sat inside. I think the thing that warmed my heart about Jerry's, you know, which has been there forever, is the enthusiasm
of that
of
yes.
everybody.
Yes.
I mean, you know, you think, you know, well, okay, so there is grouper on the menu. Well, you get like a half-hour soliloquy about grouper if you order grouper. The waitress went into this major thing about smoked mullet and devil crab and the hash browns being fantastic. And, you know, the food is great. It's wonderful. It's like kind of all American, American graffiti type stuff. But there's just something so endearing in this day and age of, you know, of not great service in places to have people who are just rhapsodizing about their food.
And we asked – actually, we asked Amy, who was our waitress, how long she had been there because she was detailing every little bit of the menu. And she said, I've been here 2 months and that's all. But she said, you want to talk to somebody who's been here a while, talk to Miss Faye. And she pointed to a plaque on the wall issued by the – Congress of the United States to Miss Faye for 50 years of service as a waitress at Jerry's Drive-In.
Well, Congress does do something worthwhile.
Yeah, there you go.
So did you eat – all right, you had the burger, but what else did you have?
The grouper. I have to say, you know, there's a lot of grouper in this part of Florida. And, you know, grouper is a wonderful – it's a very delicate kind of elegant fish. And Amy described to us that we could have it – one of three ways. We could have it broiled. She said, that's very good. She said, you can have it fried, and that's good. But the best is light fried. And that's like fried, but with the thinnest, almost like a tempura crust on it. So, I mean, that's nice because you taste the crust, and there's a little bit of seasoning in it. But inside is that really kind of moist, mellow grouper, which is very unlike any other fish I've ever tasted.
Yeah, I love that you can get two different types of fried, heavy coating and light coating.
Yeah.
I think that's brilliant.
It's that kind of place. And, you know, they make great milkshakes. And it's just the kind of place that if we lived in Pensacola, I think we'd be there like five times a week.
We'd be like Miss Faye.
Right.
We'd have a 50-year plaque on the wall.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, Lynn, take care.
Bye-bye.
Gene and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. Now, you can find their picks on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, what does food taste like when you're floating in zero gravity? Astronaut Chris Hadfield has the story. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Splendid Table is brought to you by All the Chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, while you may know him best for a zero-gravity rendition of David Bowie's Space Oddity that went viral last year, Colonel Chris Hadfield is known for a few other things. Among them, he's flown three space missions, conducted two spacewalks, and spent a total of 6 months in space. He's most recently served as commander of the International Space Station. LA Times' Noelle Carter sat down with Colonel Hadfield to talk about what life is like miles above the earth.
Chris, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Noelle, it's a delight. Thanks for the invitation.
You know, along with everything else you've done, you've gained worldwide acclaim for your photography, educational videos, and amazing social media posts from the space station. You've really shown the awesomeness of the everyday in space. And in one of your videos, you open a can of nuts, and the nuts look like they're literally vibrating as if they're alive. So what's it like eating in space?
You know, that was spooky when we opened that can of nuts, just because of weightlessness. It suddenly looked like it was infested with small living insects. And it was such a shock to look in that I thought, well, you know, if this surprises me and surprises Tom, I bet you it'll surprise everybody. And so we made a video. And all eating is sort of like that. You know, you can't have a bag of chips because the crumbs would go everywhere and you'd breathe them, and you have to make different food choices. And there's no refrigeration and no microwave, so it's a different menu. But eating in space is healthy, and our dietitians work really hard. And I actually showed up back on Earth a little bit more fit, a little bit less fat, and at exactly the same weight. So it's not a bad health spa.
That's wild. I was going to say, it kind of sounds like eating in space is a little like camping.
Yes, it is. Or maybe an extended sailing trip or something where you just don't have the spare electricity and hardware to do a normal meal. The difference being, though, you can't set anything on a plate. My wife is a chef, and she constantly talks about plating things. That's a gravity thing. We end up eating like college students out of bags, because you can't mix your potatoes and your gravy and your roast beef, because they're all in separate containers, and there's no convenient weightless way to put them all in one spot.
So I'm curious, how is food chosen for space? What kind of criteria do they look for?
You know, it's a lot driven by just how it gets there. Our delivery trucks are complex and esoteric and really infrequent. For example, if we chose to have some nice French food made by La Casse, which we did, and they manufacture it somewhere in a factory in France, but it has to meet really stringent controls. Of course, we don't want to get food poisoning. And then they package it a certain way, and then they have to ship it to NASA in Houston, who goes through, does all the quality control, packs it up for space, and then Houston needs to ship it to whatever rocket provider is going to launch it to the space station. It might be in Guyana, it might be in Japan, it might be in Russia, or it might be in Florida. And then it gets launched to us, could be months later, and then you get it on board, and then we have to store it for who knows how long, might be a year before that particular crew gets on board.
Now, when you finally decide to eat the food, you rehydrate it, and is there any way to heat it up?
We have like a little easy bake oven up there. It just amused me when I first saw it. It's so much like an easy bake oven where it's just heated by a little heater element, and you take your can or your little pouch of food and you put it in there and close the door on it, maybe sort of like a waffle iron kind of idea, and just enough that it warms it up to just slightly too hot to eat so that it'll cool just a second and then you can eat it. And that works for cans and pouches of prepared stuff. And then for the dehydrated stuff, we have what looks like the little needle that you fill up a basketball with. We have one of those sort of sticking out of the wall. And you take your container, say, of, I don't know, dehydrated, even shrimp, in fact, freeze-dried dehydrated shrimp. You slide the little septum over top of that needle. You turn to the right number of ounces of water, and you push hot or cold, depending if you want hot shrimp or cold shrimp. But, of course, it's got horseradish sauce, the red sauce. It says, you know, on the package in Russian and in English, how to make your shrimp krevetki. You shake it up, you let it sit for a while, and then you have to carefully cut it open with scissors, of course, because it's in a sealed package. And then you want to open it so you don't spurt horseradish cocktail sauce all over the inside of the spaceship, because nothing falls to the floor. And then one by one, you grab the shrimp and eat them. And you think back to some shrimp fisherman somewhere who pulled those out of the sea, probably never suspecting that little shrimp was going to end up going 5 miles a second to be eaten a few years later on board the International Space Station.
That's absolutely wild. I you mentioned something about spicy foods you know, the senses, how your senses are affected in space. What is it about spicy foods, and is it possible to season what you eat in space?
When you're without gravity, when you're weightless on board the space station, if you think about it, there's no way for your sinuses to mechanically drain like they do on Earth. It's as if you perpetually stood on your head, so your sinuses just sort of clog up. It's as if you have a head cold forever. And everybody knows when you got a bad head cold, you just can't taste your food because your sinuses don't reflect the smells of it and your tongue's a little bit swollen. So it masks the subtle tastes of food. So you do like the spicy stuff. We have the Louisiana hot sauce and Tabasco sauce, and I really like the horseradish on the shrimp cocktail. But to try and actually mix stuff together or add condiments even pepper. You know, of course, pepper is a powder that you rely on gravity to drop onto your plate. That right. won't work. So we take olive oil and put pepper in it, sort of suspended. And when you want pepper, you sort of squirt it directly onto what you're going to eat. And we do it the same with salt. We use salt water. And you wow. squirt your salt water on your food. That's about as complicated as we can get in our little cuisine kitchen on board.
Now, being in space, the sun rises and sets so many times in a 24-hour period while you're on the space station, and it seems like you kind of have to manufacture a day. Do you eat regular meals like we would on Earth, and is everyone on the same daily schedule?
Typically, we all live on the same daily schedule, and as you say, you have to manufacture it. We just have to decide when morning is, because we go around the world 16 times a day. So we could have chosen anybody's time zone. We found over the years it's more efficient if everybody works on the same time, and we compromised in between Mission Control in Houston and Mission Control in Moscow. So we chose just London, England. So we all get up at the same time as everybody in London at Greenwich. We get up, and breakfast is sort of on your own. You know, whatever you particularly like, because everyone's taking turns in the toilet. You know, it's like living right. in a dormitory. And then lunch is sort of on the fly as well, because everyone's period for experiments is maybe doesn't overlap properly. But supper time, dinner time, we try and definitely get together. I was the commander of the ship, and I really wanted people, for the social and the psychological benefit of it, to get together at dinner time. And typically, whoever's done their work for the day a little bit early will sing out about an hour before lunch, "Hey, is this okay for dinner? What do you want? You know, is this okay?" And they'll start putting stuff in the little heating element device. It sort of looks like a small silver Samsonite suitcase that you squeeze your food into. Okay. And they'll rehydrate some food, and they'll lay it out on the table. And then we'll get together with as many of us as we can, and including the Russians who mostly work down in the other end of the station. We all want to share the experiences of the day and right. laugh and talk about what went on. And eating time, just like it is around a family table or for a group of friends at a restaurant, it's really important on the space station also.
That's great. So with everyone from different nationalities, do you guys all eat the same food, or does everybody bring different foods from their countries? How does that work?
Luckily, everybody brings different foods from their countries. You get to order months, years, in fact, in advance from this big list of – and we do food tasting. I sat – instead of going and feeding myself in Russia, we would sit down with their dietitians and their cooks, and they would give us a little morsel of, say, 40 or 50 different types of food that day. And you'd try it, and you'd rate it 1 to 10. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of it, you would say to them, "Hey, I want everything that is an 8 and above. Please
really?
Give me 50% that." And then the same thing with the NASA-provided food. And then the other partners, the Japanese, the Europeans, and the Canadians, you can say maybe get a few of the top items from Japan or from Canada or from Europe. And then we get to do what are called bonus packs. And typically people will get just a nice variety so that when we're having a dinner, someone can bring out some duck confit or some some specialty food from somewhere, some canned camembert cheese or some Russian borscht or something that is really ethnic and great, and share it with everybody else. And having that variety, it's nice to have the food that gives you comfort, but it's really nice also to have the delight of something new on a regular basis.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. It was so much fun talking to you, and I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you very much, Noelle. It was really nice to talk with you again, and I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
This is Ground Control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirt you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule.
Chris Hadfield is author of An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. Noelle Carter is the test kitchen director of the LA Times. Now, you can find an extended version of that interview on our website, splendidtable.org. Getting tired of spring mix and Caesar salads? They feel a little out of season. Well, we're going to help shake things up. Our producer, Sally Swift, is going to a chef known for her fresh take on greens, Jen Lewis of Portland's Lincoln Restaurant.
Hey, Jen, nice to have you with us.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
So here we are in the dregs of produce land for some of us in the winter months. What kind of inspiration might you have for us for some new salad ideas?
Well, I kind of look to see what's available locally. I love the whole idea of local and sustainable, but the real thing is that when you use what is in season and local, it hasn't traveled that far, it tastes great, it's most flavorful because it's really freshest. So what we have locally is a lot of chicory, so radicchio, treviso, that type of green, or lettuce, and we also have cabbages that get, they hold true pretty well through the winter. So I try to focus on those types of lettuces or vegetables rather than what you traditionally think of as a lettuce salad.
Yeah, so not really any lettuce. Really talking, you're talking greens here.
For sure. Those are what's really good for you in the wintertime, too, if you think of a health benefit. Things like kale, they have all of that great iron and, you know, citrus that have all the great vitamin C. All of those things are really important for you for your winter diet.
So let's get to kale, which is, of course, everyone's love child right now.
Right.
Do you have an idea for a new take on it for us?
Well, I love raw kale. I think it's gotten incredibly popular, which is great because it's a good, healthy green to eat. I like it raw. I like it with a few different flavor profiles. Sometimes I serve it with a goat cheese vinaigrette or a blue cheese vinaigrette, something that's kind of bright and acidic so that it pulls out some of that iron and chlorophyll and kind of brightens it up. I love it with citrus. I love serving it with grapefruit especially, persimmons when they're in season. And I like to think of texture in my food as well. So instead of breadcrumbs, which are delicious, or croutons, I like to think of something like cocoa nibs. It has a real rich, deep flavor.
Cocoa nibs? So explain what cocoa nibs are.
Well, cocoa nibs are the roasted bean that's kind of been broken apart into small pieces. They have a great texture. They are crunchy, but they're not hard. They've got fat in them so that they have a really nice texture. They're almost like maybe the texture of a little bit of a hard walnut.
And they taste chocolatey.
They do, but they don't taste like the chocolate that you're eating in a chocolate bar. It doesn't have the sugar added, but it's got that deep chocolate coffee flavor.
I bet it's great with the kale. Are you a kale massager, may I ask?
I am. It can be kind of toothy. It can be a little tough to eat. But I do find that when I toss a salad of kale, I don't like big leaves of kale. I like to julienne mine, so really thin strips.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put it into a bowl with maybe some shallot and some salt and pepper and my vinaigrette. And I toss it and kind of squeeze it and massage it kind of roughly to kind of break up some of that tough texture.
I think it's one of the funnier things we've been doing of late. But it's true, it helps to massage that kale a little bit.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So do you do anything with bread salads in the winter?
I do. I have one at our tavern right now, at Sunshine Tavern, and it has roasted fennel, oil-cured olives. I put some salami in there and some cheese. It has a really bright red wine vinaigrette. So I put the croutons that have been cooked with a little bit of Parmigiano, and then I toss them with the vinaigrette so they can soften just a little bit, but they still keep a good amount of texture. At Lincoln, we've been running one that has winter squash. So you can use anything, pumpkin, you know, delicata squash, acorn, butternut, whatever you prefer, whatever you have on hand. You know, even if you have some left from dinner the night before, cube it up. Blue cheese goes beautifully.
I bet that's great with the big chunks of bread and squash.
And it can be a really fun salad. If you have Brussels sprouts left or roasted onions from dinner the night before, it's a really great place to use some roasted vegetables. I like to toss the breadcrumbs or the croutons ahead with a little bit of vinaigrette just to soften up a little bit, then add my vegetables, a little more vinaigrette, season it. But you can use a good variety of vegetables.
And what about cabbage?
Cabbage is great. I love cabbage. It's funny because I think a lot of people think of cabbage as slaw.
Yeah, we think of summer. We don't think of using it in the winter.
Exactly. And in the wintertime, we have really great heirloom cabbages. We have the Italian ones that are kind of conical in shape, the green ones. We have this one that's a red mammoth cabbage, which I think is, it's an heirloom. But they're really, really lovely. I love the red cabbage with a bacon vinaigrette and dried cherries. I think that's really wonderful, and I like to have a little bit of roasted shallot in that one. With the green cabbage, I really love the blue cheese vinaigrette. Sometimes we'll put some bacon or some house pancetta that we make. Some horseradish vinaigrette is wonderful in there as well with some apple. So there's a good variety that you can really take that one ingredient and do a variety of things.
Those are great ideas. Thanks so much, Jen.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jen Lewis is chef owner of Lincoln and the Sunshine Tavern in Portland, Oregon. She left us with a handful of winter green recipes, including that kale salad. Now, you can find them on the website, splendidtable.org.
You never call my name.
We are talking with you this hour. Connect with us. Call us 800-537-5252. Shoot us an email at splendidtable.org and check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, let's see who's been waiting. We've got Bob. He's calling from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Bob, welcome, and what do you want to talk about?
Well, hello, Lynn. Great to talk with you.
Good to talk with you,
mortar
too.
Mortar and pestles. I have recently purchased a mortar and pestle basically for dry spice grinding.
Oh, yeah.
And I would like to know how best to season it before use.
Now, what kind is it?
It's a marble.
Okay. And what did you read?
I read that grinding rice basically into it to clean the surface and then grinding unpeeled garlic, cumin seed, salt, and pepper. What does the garlic do to the surface of the...
Oh, I think that's kind of very old information. The rice, first of all, what you want to do, because you see marble's really porous, and I wouldn't do garlic and cumin seed and whatever, because if you're going to use it as a spice grinder, there's enough chance of it picking up scents and whatever. And that's not a big deal, you know, and it really isn't. But when you're using pretty strong scents to kind of, you know, season this thing, best not. Now, the grinding of the rice helps clean the surface, but other things that help clean the surface is something pretty simple, which is hot water and very little bit of soap, but hot water essentially, and you give it, you know, a nice, you know, swishing around and whatever, and then let it dry completely, you know, in open air, and then what you want to do is grind some rice in it, because sometimes there's a coating on the marble to protect it. And that's about it as far as, I mean, I collect these babies, and I do not recommend this because no kitchen counter can generally hold a large collection. I've learned this all vaguely the hard way. But I would say the best thing to do is to give it a good washing with hot water, tiny bit of soap, rinse the you-know-what out of it, and then dry completely, and then grind the rice in it, wipe it out. And every time you use it, give it a wash, okay? Because, again, you don't want to have those spices permeating the marble and flavoring it. It's not going to make a huge difference. But when you're using something really pungent, like if you're grinding chilies and garlic and that kind of thing, that's where you just want to not let it sit around and get absorbed into the marble. You want to give it a quick rinse right away. And you're going to love it.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye. Well, we're going to be right back with more of your questions. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We are back to talk with you. Call us at 800-537-5252. And Melissa is calling from Durango, Colorado. Do you have a question?
I do. So I grew up in Missouri, and my grandfather had a persimmon tree.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I remember eating the persimmons as a child. And just recently, I picked up some at the grocery store that were ripe. They put them in a bag, you know, when the produce is getting ready to go bad.
Right,
they put it in
right.
a bag and mark it down.
Right. And that's exactly when persimmons are at their best.
Exactly.
Yeah,
So I bought it and decided to try baking something with it because I love to bake. So I made some bread and I made some persimmon bars. And they were good, but they just didn't burst with the persimmon flavor.
Yeah.
And they add baking soda, which I didn't know because I've never baked with them before, but the recipe is called to add baking soda to the persimmon pulp and let it sit for a few minutes and that sort of thing. So how can I really bring out the persimmon flavor in those baked goods?
Well, I think, first of all, one of the things that always brings out the flavor of a fruit is a little bit of lemon juice.
Okay.
A little bit of lemon juice. And depending on the recipe, and both of these recipes sound really forgiving, it's not like you're making an angel food cake, you know, where if you add more of something, the cake is just going to go, you know, kaplooey. It's going to have a nervous breakdown. I would add more persimmon. And I'm not sure why the baking soda neutralizes acids. And maybe that's why it's being added, because the persimmon is rather acidic. And that may be the reason, because I have to say, what I've done generally with persimmon, I've not baked with it as much as I've pureed and made a sorbet out of it, you know, and thrown in a little cream. And I add a tad of ginger to that and a little bit of lime or lemon. And if it needs a more sweetness, I'll add a little bit of sugar, but I'll freeze it in chunks and then I'll puree it. And it comes out as this sorbet,
yeah.
You know, or we've done it cut up in chunks and done in the top of a tart, you know, so that it's all about the persimmon. And sprinkle it with cinnamon and lemon and throw it in the oven. And then you get pure fruit flavor. But I think in this case, increase the persimmon by at least 25%, maybe 30%. I do a little bit of lemon. Take that persimmon and see what makes it taste better. The raw persimmon.
Okay.
You know, like, is it a little teeny bit of cinnamon? Is it a little bit of lemon or lime? Is it just a tad of sugar? Is it a drop of almond extract? Because, for instance, with stone fruit, almond extract does miraculous things. You don't even know it's there, but it lifts everything. So I'd play with it. A bit of vanilla might work. But that's what I would do. But first, I'd increase it, because if the bread is heavier, great. It's moist and it's delicious. And the bars, well, you know, the more persimmon, the better.
Right.
Yeah, so that's what I do.
Awesome. Great. Thank you so much. We enjoy listening to your show and getting inspired by ideas.
Well, you're living in one of my favorite parts of Colorado.
Well, come see us anytime.
And thank you for listening.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Karina's on the line from Minneapolis. Karina, what do you want to talk about?
I am calling because I had a cooking disaster the other night.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I was making a lemon pasta sauce. It's one of these quick sauces where you saute some garlic, toss in your lemon zest, add your lemon juice, a little touch of cream, and some pasta water.
Right.
It can be thrown together easily while the pasta's cooking.
Sounds wonderful.
It is. However, the last time I made it, when I added the lemon juice, all of a sudden the garlic turned the color of the Statue of Liberty, that awful patinaed copper green.
This is a chemical reaction, and at one time in my life, I actually could tell you exactly what was happening, and it's dropped out the back of my brain. but it is something that happens occasionally when you mix an acid with garlic. I can't tell you how to avoid it, but what I can tell you is that you can buffer it.
Okay.
And the way you would buffer it is the lemon goes in at the end. And the one thing, too, about putting the lemon in at the very end is you will have the brightest, freshest flavor imaginable. Because whenever you heat a citrus fruit, you know, like grapefruit juice, orange juice, lemon juice,
something happens. It's like you've put a big, thick blanket over the taste. It all flattens out and gets muted. But you know that sparkle you get from fresh lemon juice?
Yeah.
That would be fabulous with that pasta. So just change the recipe. Add the lemon at the end and save yourself some aggravation.
Great. Thank you so much. What an easy fix. Was it safe to consume?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good, because that was one of my concerns, actually.
No, I can understand. And also, you know, green verdigris-colored garlic doesn't make for the prettiest presentation.
No, fortunately, it was just a family dinner, not a company dinner.
And they're so forgiving. All right, Karina, you take care. And
thanks so much, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Call us 800-537-5252. Shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Well, Irene is on the phone, and she's calling from Paris, California. Irene, good to talk to you. What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about fresh fenugreek leaves.
Whoa!
I found them in my local market, and I've used them to make a wonderful bean dish with lemon and garlic and whatever beans I happen to have
right
ready to go. I want to use those fresh fenugreek leaves a lot, but I don't want everything to taste like Indian food.
Right, right. Normally you get fenugreek as the seed, and it has that funky, I don't know, how do you describe the flavor? Because I have to confess, I've never worked with the leaves.
I don't know how you describe the flavor. I just love it.
Because if I remember, the fenugreek seed, which you use a lot in Indian cooking, has a funky but slightly citrusy quality to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Does that sound like the leaf as well? Because there should be a relationship, obviously.
I've made a stew, a Yemeni stew, with the fenugreek powder that comes from the leaves. And it had the same aroma as what was coming out of that bean dish, so there's a similarity in flavor.
Right. Well, one of the first things that comes to my mind when you said that is yogurt and a yogurt sauce. Let's back up a minute. You grill a piece of fish, and what you would do is scatter the leaves over the grill to give it just, you know, a sense, a little bit of smokiness from the leaves. And then I would do a yogurt sauce with that, where you mince up garlic, you do lemon, you chop a little bit of the fenugreek, and you put that into whole milk yogurt. And you could have drained the yogurt a little so it's thick,
mm-hmm.
or use, in quotes, Greek yogurt, which is just drained yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do that to taste, add those leaves to taste, because I know fenugreek can be very pungent. I'd imagine the leaves might, you know, are not necessarily super delicate. The yogurt is that tangy but yet creamy quality, which should play with those leaves beautifully, with the fenugreek flavor. And over seafood, it would be, I mean, this could really be fabulous. Over something like, well, I'm thinking of something like a grilled, something in the bass family, or even salmon. But I keep thinking of something that would be a warm water fish. So that would be one idea. Another idea is to think about using it in anything else that's creamy, because this is the kind of flavor that takes to creamy finishes. So you're doing some sort of pan sauté of vegetables, and you would add that fenugreek after you've removed the vegetables to the pan to deglaze it, along with a little bit of cream or a little bit of sour cream. And that mixture would work really brilliantly. And the other thing is, I could imagine it'd be wonderful with eggplant. You know, stewed eggplant. And it doesn't have to be Indian-style stewed eggplant. It could be the garlic, the onion, or the shallots, and then let that fenugreek shine through. So that's, never having worked with the leaf, but having worked with the seed, those would be a few of my ideas.
Well, that's great. I hope you go find some of those leaves and play with them, because they are really fun.
I haunt Indian markets, but I think I have missed them, and I'm going to look more closely now. Thank you, though. This is turning us on to something that we maybe haven't done before.
Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome, Irene. Have a good one.
Bye.
Bye. You know, this idea of fenugreek, oh, boy, it's so hard to describe the flavor. You use too much of it and it takes over. But it's one of those things, especially when you're doing Indian food, you leave it out and it's you left out a piece of a foundation of a building. And as I said, it's funky and yet it has a citrusy overtone. The whole seed lasts a long time in the cupboard. But I'm now going to look for the leaves. Well, you can look for us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can call us 800-537-5252, or you can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. You tell an Italian that you're going to create hams equal to the famous prosciutto di Parma, and that you're going to do it in Iowa. I think they're going to kind of fall on the floor laughing, and so will Italian food experts on this side of the puddle. But that's what Herb Eckhaus and his wife, Kathy, did with their La Quercia hams, and did it very well. There is a catch. Their sense of the ham came from living in Parma. They understand the culture behind the meat. It's about salt, air, time, and a lot of skill. Herb Eckhaus joins us from Norwalk, Iowa. Herb, it's good to talk to you.
Thank you, Lynn.
So, Herb, Iowa prosciutto. Okay.
It's kind of a head-turning line.
Yes.
It was always one of those things that caught people by surprise. I mean, certainly people were skeptical, but once they tasted it, it was a ton of fun.
Could you describe what a great prosciutto tastes like?
Okay, well, I like to break it into three components, the foretaste, the middle taste, and the aftertaste.
Uh-huh.
So, like, first of all, for me, for a great prosciutto, it shouldn't be too salty. I don't want to get hit by salt when I put it in my mouth, and I don't want to get hit by salt as the flavor builds, and I don't want to be left at the end with my tongue being ridged because I've taken up so much salt. So I really prefer sweet prosciutto or prosciutto that has the minimum amount of salt. Then kind of the other big flavor component in prosciutto is umami, which is that kind of indescribable savory flavor that you get with aged foods like aged Parmigiano Reggiano. And, you know, it just has this very rich, nutty, somewhere between savory and sweet flavor, and that's a key component. Right now, I would say my favorite prosciutto is our Tamworth prosciutto. And, you know, it has that umami flavor in the foretaste, and then in the mid-taste, it builds this really deep, sweet kind of caramel flavor, and that flavor carries through to the aftertaste and the finish.
Now, Tamworth is a breed of pig.
It's a breed of pig, yeah. It's considered a threatened breed in the United States. I read something recently that Prince Charles, who's, you know, known as somebody who cares deeply about his food, and, you know, had his own line of organic specialty food, he actually raises Tamworth pigs, and he sent some Tamworth legs to Di Bello in Italy to be cured into culatello.
So, oh, my. Culatello being the paragon of cured pork leg, but just a hint above the prosciutto.
I think, you know, it's rare. It's a very special cut, and it's extremely perishable. That's, you know, that's why we don't make it, because I feel it's too perishable to deliver a good eating experience to people in a country as big as this one.
Well, what is the difference between the ham in the supermarket that we usually buy and a prosciutto?
Well, the fundamental difference is ham that you buy in the supermarket is cooked. So there are three ways that you can, you know, protect meat and make it safe to eat for a long period. One of the ways is to cook it, and, you know, you kill the bacteria by heating them. Mm-hmm. One of them is to dry it, and that's what we do with prosciutto. So you take the water out, and then the bacteria can't live. Then when you dry the meat, you can then age it, and you get that really rich, complex flavor and the transformation of texture.
And the time that goes into drying that and curing it?
Well, for us, it varies with the kind of meat that we're using and the way we prepare it, but it's a minimum of 9 months and a maximum of about 3 years.
Very similar to it is what they do in Italy.
Yeah.
So how did you go from a corporate executive to becoming a maker of prosciutto?
Well, it was one of those ideas that you have in your life and you think, wow, this is a good idea and maybe I should do something about it. But this time I decided I was actually going to do something about it. It was the right time in my life to do it. You know, we had lived in Italy and we'd eaten a lot of prosciutto, and we came back to Iowa, and the idea came to us, well, gosh, maybe we could make prosciutto here, and after all, it is, it only has two ingredients, pork and sea salt, and there are more pigs than people in Iowa, so we got the we've got the ingredients. And, you know, then as we were kind of contemplating and planning, you know, it really came to me that when we'd lived in Italy, our friends every day got up and expected that they were going to have an eating experience that was going to make them feel good to be alive. And this was something that we wanted to bring to people in the United States. You know, when you eat something delicious, you feel connected to creation and you feel happy to be alive. And so that really became our focus, to really show our appreciation for the bounty around us and make people feel good.
Herb, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Lynn. Great to talk to you.
Herb Eckhouse and his wife, Kathy, have Lucretia Cured Meats in Norwalk, Iowa. Now, for more information, head to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's our show for this week. Hey, thanks for listening. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Elaine Boozler. Pigs are smarter than dogs, and both are smarter than Congress. Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Now head over to splendidtable.org to get information on everything you heard here today and so much more. Get registered for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. We send you a recipe for weeknight eating every single week. And you can also listen to us whenever you'd like. Download our podcasts at our podcast network, infiniteguest.org. You'll find the Splendid Table there, of course, as well as a collection of other shows, including Big Appetites, a podcast with Sally Swift and her friend Patty Hinnich. It's all about what happens in their kitchens on their days off. Find them at infiniteguest.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.